Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm absolutely tickled to welcome back to the program today Bill Bryson. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Vic. How are you?
Wonderful. You've got a new book, One Summer, America, 1927. Bill, how did you decide to focus on the summer of 1927? How did this happen?
Kind of an accident. I mean, my starting point was that I'd always been fascinated by the fact that in the summer of 1927, two really big events happened simultaneously. One was Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs, and Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. And I kind of had a vague idea that it might be interesting to try to do a dual biography of these two very iconic figures, and with the idea that this sort of narrative would be heading towards the summer of 1927, when it would, you know, when these events would intersect. And then I discovered that lots and lots of other things of equal importance, and sometimes even more interesting, happened in the summer of 1927. So it became a book about the summer rather than about these two guys.
There sure were a lot of wacky aviators loose in the summer of 1927.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I mean, I really had no idea. I'd always just kind of assumed, as I think many people do, that Lindbergh had independently just gotten it into his head that he would try to fly to Paris, and he'd done it, and that made him famous. But actually, you know, there was a huge race going on at the time, and Lindbergh was very much, very, very much the dark horse. There were lots and lots of other teams that had bigger planes, that were better prepared, and were expected to, you know, win this race, to be the first to fly from New York to Paris and collect this thing called the Ortigue Prize. And Lindbergh surprised them all, just stunned them all by coming from out of nowhere, just this kid who's 25 years old, and you know, snatched it away from them. And that was really why he became so famous and so celebrated.
And there's all these other people, some of them trying to fly to Paris, but some of them trying to go the other direction, or they're going to different countries. And in so many cases, you cite where they took off, and usually it's some ridiculous thing going on with you know, the whole expedition, and then they just vanish, and they're never seen again.
There was a lot of planes, you know, splashed down in the ocean and were never seen again. It was really, really hard. I mean, it was right at the very edge of what technology could achieve in 1927 to fly that kind of distance. And, you know, oceans are very, very unforgiving. If your airplane, the engine cuts out, you know, you go down, that's it. Nobody knows whatever became of you. Lindbergh's flight was very probably the greatest single piece of aviation by any flyer in history. And again, I didn't realize that until I did the book and discovered, you know, how many other people failed spectacularly. Not just, you know, didn't get there, but even the ones that did get there, well, another team led by a Commander Byrd missed Ireland by 250 miles. You know, they couldn't find Paris. And that was with a full-time navigator and a radio operator. You know, so what Lindbergh did in flying straight from Roosevelt Field in Long Island to Le Bourget Airfield in Paris was an incredible achievement for the time.
Bill Bryson joins us. His new book is One Summer, America, 1927. And the thing that you keep driving home about Charles Lindbergh was the fact that he couldn't see in front of him.
No, that was amazing because it was, well, you know, they described his plane as really just a kind of, you know, fuel tank with wings, and in a lot of ways it was. And in order to pack on the necessary amount of aviation fuel, he put a big, big fuel tank in front where the cockpit would normally be. So he had no forward visibility at all in his airplane. He argued that he didn't need it flying over an ocean. There's nothing to crash into, you know, so he didn't really need to see forward very well. But then, you know, after his successful flight, then he did this victory tour around America and visited all 48 states, and you know, he was landing on airfields where there were people in an airplane that he couldn't see forward at all. Just it must have been so unnerving.
Well, by a really weird coincidence, Bill, the book I read right before I read yours was also set in 1927. It's called.
No, really?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. It's called The Tilted World by Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Fenley, and it's a novel about the Great Mississippi Flood. A lot of people don't even know this happened.
Yeah. It's kind of a forgotten event. Quite a few of these events in summer 1927 are forgotten, I find. There was a wonderful nonfiction book about the Great Mississippi Flood called Rising Tide that was written a few years ago. And that was what sort of alerted me to just how big a deal it was. But the whole of the Mississippi-Missouri River system flooded. So, I mean, you know, just a huge amount of the United States was sodden and underwater. But the Mississippi itself would just overflowed its banks. And for about 3 months, there was essentially a new Great Lake in the very middle of the country.
Another really important aspect of this particular year was that the movie industry was going crazy, but we hadn't made the transition to talking pictures. And you make a point in this section of the book that really struck me, and it's that as soon as talking pictures started and people all over the world started seeing movies where American actors were speaking in American accents, that America took over the world in a way. I'd never thought of this.
Yeah, well, it really kind of underlined America's dominance. And there's, you know, a real sort of subliminal message there when even people like, you know, King Henry VIII are talking with American accents and Christopher Columbus and the kind of message that goes out to the world is that, you know, Americans do everything and have done everything. And it's still true now, you know. I mean, people, a big part of the reason that America has the sort of respect and admiration it has in the world is because, you know, wherever you are in the world, if you go to the movies or turn on the TV or listen to radio, it's very, very often American voices that predominate.
Another thing that really struck me about this period was that you make the statement that books and writers were so important, so big. Everyone was reading books. This really warmed my heart.
Mine too. It was probably the last great year or so for reading. I mean, because there wasn't a lot of competition for your time. Every city had at least two newspapers, a morning and evening newspaper, and some night New York had a dozen or more. And that was what people did. They either read books or they read newspapers. But because there wasn't a lot else to do, you know, radio was still pretty much in its infancy. It was becoming really, really popular, but it was only in 1926 and 1927 that network radio began, you know, and you needed network radio to make radio really professional and have kind of first-class quality and entertainment. And that was still just barely beginning. So you know, if you were at home in the evening and had nothing to do, reading was how you passed the time.
Bill Bryson joins us. His new book is One Summer, America, 1927. He's on book tour. He's joining us by telephone from beautiful Sacramento, California. I just loved the baseball segments in here, and I actually listened to the audiobook version because I wanted to hear you read your own book. And when I got to the point near the end when Babe Ruth ties his own record and hits his 59th home run and then breaks the record and hits his 60th home run, to hear you describe the action, I thought to myself, Bill's dad would be so proud of him.
Oh, wow. Well, that's the nicest thing anybody said to me in a long time, Vic. Thank you very much. I was really into it. I love baseball, and because I live in England, I really miss baseball, so it's not a part of my daily life anymore. So it was a real indulgence for me to have baseball be such a big part of this book. And it wasn't just Babe Ruth, you know. I mean, it was also a really interesting year for people like Lou Gehrig and even Walter Johnson, the great old pitcher, who's something that I thought was wonderful was said and completely forgotten is that on the very game that Babe Ruth hit his 60th home run, it was Walter Johnson's last game in Major League Baseball. He retired after that game. And I thought that was kind of fitting in a way.
We also have these fascinating characters, the president, Calvin Coolidge, and the future president, Herbert Hoover. What a pair.
Yeah, I really got to like Coolidge. I didn't expect to. I mean, I would never argue that he was a great president or anything like that, but I kind of found him strangely endearing as a human being. And Hoover was almost the opposite. I mean, Hoover was very much misunderstood as a public figure. He gets blamed for the Great Depression, not entirely fairly. I mean, he kind of inherited the situation that led to the Great Depression. So but he was a really, really unlikable human being. I mean, he was just really cold, and nobody it seems who spent any time around him liked him as a human being. And that's kind of unfortunate, especially for me, is because, you know, Hoover's from Iowa and I'm from Iowa, and he was our great state hero. So I wanted to be warm to him, but just couldn't.
Well, Bill, we are both from Des Moines. We went to the same high school. I don't remember anybody being particularly fond of Herbert Hoover. We were proud he was the only president from Iowa, but beyond that, he was alive still.
Des Moines has got to be the only place in the nation that would have a Herbert Hoover high school.
Well, that's true. We also have bootlegging and prohibition, and what a time. Wow. You really get into the fact that prohibition seemed to encourage drinking.
Yeah, it was strange. It really did, because it made it, you know, it gave it a kind of racy edge that I think was very appealing to young people in particular. And also, it drove people, everybody, almost everywhere, it drove people to drink harder stuff, you know, because beer wasn't available and even wine wasn't available. You know, if you were going out partying, you had to drink, you know, gin or sort of rot gut type gin, but, you know, hard stuff. And that meant that a whole generation of people were drinking a lot, you know, a lot more devotedly than they had been before. All the kind of gentle sipping that you get when drinking, you know, when there isn't prohibition, went out the window, and instead there became this period of kind of wild abandon.
Bill Bryson joins us. His new book is One Summer, America 1927. It's true, beer was not widely available because it was hard to conceal a brewery, except in places like Chicago.
Yeah, it was. You know, if you were going to have breweries, you had to have a lot of corruption, because, as you say, Vic, you know, you can't hide a brewery. You can't, you know, pretend it's not there. So in places like Chicago, I mean, breweries still cranked out beer more or less openly, and police and all of the other city officials turned a blind eye to it. And in a way, that was, you know, Al Capone managing all that was doing a public service, because he did two things. He provided people with a choice of drinks that were, you know, not as intoxicating and not as dangerous to the body. And his stuff was also reliable. Part of the reason he was so successful is that his stuff was never poisoned, or, you know, he didn't use adulterated alcohol or alcohol that was, you know, kind of just mixed up in a batch somewhere. His stuff was, you know, you got decent booze from him.
This was also a period of tremendous xenophobia, and you talk about a lurid murder where a woman and her lover kill her husband and then leave an Italian anarchist newspaper there to try to deflect suspicion towards Italian anarchists. And this is the same period where Sacco and Vanzetti were executed.
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of ugliness in the period too, and a lot of sort of ill will towards immigrants, and particularly at that time towards Italian immigrants, partly because there was a fairly substantial anarchist movement in America, which was dominated by Italian immigrants, and they, you know, they were setting off bombs, a lot of them throughout the 20s, a lot of bombs went off, and some of them did quite a lot of damage, and it must have been, you know, pretty unnerving, because they would blow up like parts of the New York subway system or that kind of thing. So you never quite knew. It probably was a little bit like, you know, in England during IRA days. So you just never knew when the next bomb might go off. And that created quite a lot of ill will towards immigrants in general, and Italian immigrants in particular. And Sacco and Vanzetti were almost certainly, you know, made scapegoats of that. They were self-declared anarchists, but they were convicted of a terrible crime that they almost certainly didn't commit.
And then we have Henry Ford, another very strange person.
Henry Ford was extremely strange and almost impossible to figure out. I mean, by almost any measure, he was not very smart at all. They think that he may actually have been essentially functionally illiterate. And people who talked to him kind of came away amazed at how dumb he was. And yet, you know, he was, in terms of being a businessman and an innovator, he was one of the greatest geniuses of all time and you know, the richest man in America. So he was this sort of dunce and simultaneously the kind of Bill Gates of his age. So he's a really, really hard person to read. And one of the complicating factors about Henry Ford was that he was also sort of wildly, and the word wildly is really appropriate, wildly anti-Semitic. He really believed that Jews were engaged in some kind of global conspiracy to ruin everything that was decent and good on Earth.
Which brings us to another really scary part of this period, and that was the people who were into eugenics and the fact that the Supreme Court went right along with them.
Yeah. Well, again, this all comes back to this kind of, there was this real feeling that a lot of the people who were coming into America, the immigrants, were of inferior stock. And there was really a lot of very, very unattractive racism, and not just, you know, against blacks, but against people from sort of Mediterranean countries and that kind of thing. And that prompted people to believe that we should be trying to breed superior people. You know, a lot of people, intelligent people from, you know, Ivy League colleges and Stanford and places like that, believed that we already had enough kind of stupid people of our own, and now we were importing lots of backward people, and that really there ought to be a national campaign to stop those people breeding and to encourage smart, superior people to breed even more sort of fervently. And this was, you know, this was widely believed and supported by a lot of people. It was a really kind of strange time for that.
Bill Bryson joins us. His book is One Summer, America, 1927. Bill, I think that we have a lot of listeners out there who are familiar with your work, in particular, a book called A Walk in the Woods. I will not neglect this book. We have a mutual friend who appears in that book, a guy that you call Stephen Katz. Is it true that they might turn that into a movie?
Well, that's been a possibility for about 10 years. Robert Redford's company bought the film rights about 10 years ago, and they've held on to them, and there have been a number of times in the past decade when they've gotten close to making a movie, I think, and then it hasn't quite happened because, as I understand it, that's a fairly common occurrence in the film world where things almost get ready for production and then something falls apart at the last minute. But it does seem that they really are on course to start filming next spring. So it looks as if it may actually get made into a movie now.
And they're talking about Redford playing you?
Well, yeah, it would be Redford playing me and Nick Nolte playing the Katz role.
Wow. And so
they wouldn't be playing us as we appear in the book. I mean, they would have to redefine the characters in some way. I mean, Katz and I were sort of, we were considerably younger. We were in our 40s and out of shape. And I think they would sort of manipulate it now so that the two walkers were older and that the problem was age more than physical fitness.
I guess they'd have to use extensive flashbacks and they could have younger characters like playing you and Katz in Turkey and you know, drinking too much Rocky and ending up going to court, and, right?
Well, if they did all that, they'd have to make it an 8-hour-long movie, I think. But I would be really, really interested to see how they would convert it to screen. They did show me, a long time ago, they showed me an early version of a script, and it was really interesting to me, you know, as the person who wrote the book on which it was based, to see how they had, you know, the kind of modifications they felt necessary to make. None of them were disturbing to me, but some of them were really quite interesting. But you know, they have to take something that would take you about 20 hours to read and make it into something that will tells the same story in 90 minutes or so. So that's an interesting process.
Bill Bryson joins us. His new book is One Summer, America, 1927. And you obviously you've done a ton of research on this book, and I see in the acknowledgments at the end that this was kind of a family project.
Oh, well, my kids helped me a lot. They did an awful lot of kind of running here and there. So I acknowledge them. They did a lot of sort of taking things to FedEx and posting things and all of that kind of thing. And frankly, they complained bitterly that I hadn't acknowledged them sufficiently in earlier books. So I decided to give them a very generous acknowledgement in this one.
Ah, very good. So the previous book, I'm guessing, probably just came out in paperback, and that's called At Home?
Yes.
Do you want to give a plug to that book and tell our listeners what that's about?
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's the whole idea of that book is I live in an old English parsonage, and the whole idea of the book was I had it in my head that it might be interesting to go from room to room in my own home and kind of try to tell a history of the world from the perspective of each room, so that the kitchen would be a history of eating and cooking, the bathroom would be a history of hygiene, the bedroom would be a history of sex and sleeping and so on. So whatever subjects are relevant to that room, I would try and tell a history. So it would be kind of how our houses and how domestic life are intertwined with global history. So instead of being a book, a history of the world, you know, told through battles and political conquests and things like that, it would be a history of the world looked at from the perspective of domesticity. And so it was just, the idea was to give a history of the world, but from a completely new angle.
And so many of your early books involved extensive travel, whether it be in a sunburned country, a walk in the woods, I'm a Stranger Here Myself. In fact, I think the first time I had you on this program was for I'm a Stranger Here Myself.
Really? Yeah, gosh. There's certain common themes to my books. One of them, which is that, you know, even though I live in England and have pretty well lived most of my adult life in England, I can't get away from America. I still, you know, I'm still drawn to America as a subject. Partly because as an American, I'm much more comfortable with dealing with American things. You know, I can write about baseball a whole lot better than I could ever write about cricket, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a lot more interested in baseball, in the history of baseball, than I would be in the history of cricket. So I'm in a kind of strange position, which is that, you know, I live in another country, but I'm still completely kind of professionally rooted in this one. And I think that gives me an interesting perspective. I mean, sometimes it's inconvenient to be living in another country and writing about another country, but it also gives you a kind of distance, I think, that allows me to sometimes see America from new angles or different perspectives that might escape me if I were living here.
Well, Bill, I can't help but get the impression that in your adopted land over there in England, they love you.
Well, not everybody does, but they've been very good to me. England's been very good to me. I think, well, you know, because I like it a lot. I mean, I do really admire a lot of things about Britain, and so I tend to, you know, say praiseworthy things about them, and so it becomes a kind of sort of virtuous reinforcing circle where I say nice things about them and then they regard me warmly as a result.
Well, I remember before that you were in Yorkshire. I have no idea where you live. I'm sure it's a big secret where you live, but I'm guessing your normal routine is probably pretty peaceful. You probably live out in the country. You've probably got a little pub you like to hang out at and just be left alone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a strange thing being a writer because, and I think this is true for a lot of writers, is, you know, part of the reason you're drawn to it in the first place is because you probably are of an introverted nature, and, you know, you spend a lot of your time alone in solitary circumstances, and then every once in a while you produce a book, and then they thrust you out into the wider world, and you just talk for like 4 or 5 weeks, and mostly talk about yourself, and it's really strange. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, it's pleasant in a lot of ways, and you meet a lot of nice people, but it's also so completely contrary to, you know, my instinct. So I have to say I am looking forward to, when this is finished, to getting back home and just going to that pub that you mentioned, really quietly and not having to explain myself to anybody.
I see your book tour is going to take you for a stop in Iowa, in Ames, and I imagine that there's going to be a lot of people driving that 40 miles from Des Moines to welcome their native son back.
Well, I hope there's enough people in Iowa, you know, in Ames to fill up an auditorium anyway. But, yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting back. I'm sure you feel the same. And, you know, there's just something special about getting back to your own state, you know, especially when you live outside it. And I don't know what it is, but I always find that when I, like if I'm driving from Chicago or something, when you cross the Mississippi and it says welcome to Iowa, my heart races a little, you know. So I'm really looking forward, seriously, to getting back and you know, being at home for a while. It's going to be too short a visit, but at least I'll be there for a while.
Are you ever going to write about your trip to Cuba with cats?
I would love to. I would love to. One day if I do some further kind of memoirs or something, that will definitely be a part in it, because we had an extraordinary experience there. And, you know, people really, really love cats and want him to reappear. So maybe I'll, you know, scoop him up and we'll go off again, and we can sort of update that adventure.
Well, he did have a little cameo in your memoir, Thunderbolt Kid, something to do with a train car full of stolen beer.
Yes, which unfortunately is a completely true story. somebody accused me of making that up, and I absolutely didn't. I mean, that was true.
With cats,
yeah, he appeared in that book as well. Yeah,
you don't need to make stuff up with cats. I mean, this guy used to drive around in an ambulance.
Yes, he is an extraordinary human being. That's for damn sure.
Yeah. Well, Bill, it's been too long, and we really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today on the program.
It's been my pleasure, Vic. It's always a pleasure talking to you. So, any time.
My guest has been Bill Bryson. His book is One Summer, America, 1927. If you really want to get into it, do what I did. Listen to the audio book because, wow, Bill, you just, what stamina? How long did it take you to record that?
Oh, it took more than 8 days, eight and a half working days. And it's murder. It really is. I mean, it's, you just think how hard it can be because all you do is sit in a little booth for all day. But at the end of the day, you're absolutely gasping. You're just completely worn out. It's really, really demanding, particularly if you're not used to doing it. But I think it's really, you know, they tell me it's really demanding even for those who do it professionally, because it's a lot harder to read with feeling than you would expect. It's like giving a performance in a way. And if you're not used to doing that, it's really quite demanding.
Well, you did a super job. Thank you so much.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Next week, a really fun book. Liesl Schillinger joins us to talk about Word Birds, an irreverent lexicon for the 21st century, in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.